Hey, what's up? This is Brock from 36 Crazy Fist, and you're rocking out to the Toilet of Hell.
You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.
Well, howdy, everybody. I'm Joe Thrashenkill. With me, I've got my co-host, 365 Days of Horror, and we got a show for you today. Kind of. I had next to nothing to do with this one. I'm a lazy slug, and I didn't do anything. But, Jordan, you did everything. So how about you tell us a little bit about this show?
Yeah, if you don't like the show, you could blame it all on me. So there's that. So I was able to speak with Brock, the vocalist from 36 Crazy Fist, which I know as our site goes, we tend to focus on, you know, more death metal, black metal, grind, kind of the more extreme metals. And 36 Crazy Fist is more of like a metalcore type band. And I know for some people that's a dirty word, but they really are, you know, one of my top 10 bands of all time. I originally discovered them via Much Music USA show Uranium. Do you remember that?
I never had cable as a kid. Much Music is the Canadian one, right?
Yeah, there was Much Music, which was the Canadian one, which was awesome because I started getting it right when I started getting into metal. And on Saturday nights, they had a show called Loud with George Strombolopoulos. He became like an actual, like, real TV journalist and ended up doing a lot of real things. But I always remember that because of his super Greek name. So Much Music had Loud, or 2-3 hours of, you know, all types of metal. And then we got something called like Much Music USA briefly, which eventually became Fuse. And I think it was on both of those channels, but it was Uranium. It was, you know, either a half hour, an hour long show where they would just play a bunch of metal videos, and their host Julia, if anyone remembers her, would, you know, interview these bands, have them on, whatever. And that's how I discovered 36 Crazy Fist. They had their video for Slit Wrist Theory. Really enjoyed it. Ended up going to college and having a fast internet and was able to download like one or two other songs off of that album. Fell in love, have every album since, seen them a bunch of times, and so this was super exciting for me.
So these folks are from Alaska, which is pretty much Canada, right?
Canada Junior.
Okay. Or Russia the Third. I don't know how any of this. I'm not a geologist. what about their sound really gets you? I know that you have, you're on the record, you're a huge Killswitch Engage fan. Is it kind of similar to that?
It's sort of in the same realms. And on one of their albums, they had Killswitch Engage's former vocalist Howard Jones did guest vocals. In the interview, Brock mentions that he's friendly with Jesse and like tried to get him on this record as well. So I think there is sort of some overlapping sounds, you know, definitely heavy, definitely has. I hate the term good cop, bad cop because it just sounds so stupid, but it definitely has the heavy vocals with the more melodic choruses. So I think it's part of that aggressive, but still catchy. And you could point your finger in the air and sing along to the fun parts that, you know, reaches out to me.
Well, what can we expect from this interview?
Well, we talk about their new album coming out, Lanterns. We talk about their new single, which we're going to play in just a little bit, called Death Eater, and kind of the metamorphosis of what Brock has gone through over the past few years on their previous record, Time and Trauma, was all about dealing with his mother's death. And this one, and he explains it more eloquently than I do, just kind of the changes he's gone through and dealing with depression and, you know, growing out of that and becoming a better person. We also talk about hockey, which I was really excited about. He's a Philadelphia Flyers fan, and I'm a New York Rangers fan, so we're rivals. I know you're in Texas, so you do have the Dallas Stars, but I'm going to take a guess and say you don't really care?
Nah, man. What's hockey?
There's probably an Austin minor league team somewhere out there, I have to assume.
There actually is. In Cedar Park, there's a some kind of affiliate league thing. It's actually super fun to go there in person and, you know, drink the $2 beers and watch dudes beat each other up.
Are they called the Austin Food Trucks?
I wish. It's like the Cedar Park. I think it's the Cedar Park Stars. It's really, really pretty depressing. They couldn't come up with a better name.
Maybe they're an affiliate of the Dallas Stars. Maybe that's why. Or is just Texas just Stars? That's all you have.
Yeah, they are an affiliate of some kind. I don't know. My buddy and I watched them the season that they won whatever minor league title it is, and got real drunk in celebration, even though we had no idea what was going on.
That sounds fun.
But I digress. What's going on in the world this week? I figure we got a couple minutes. We can touch on a couple of things before I pull a cord and let you go solo on this interview.
Do we want to talk about Charlottesville?
I have opinions. I'll be honest with you. I've been pretty indisposed with a bunch of really heavy shit lately, so I don't know all the details about Charlottesville other than what I've occasionally pulled up and just looked at it on Twitter. I know that Baked Alaska, that Twitter guy that needs attention. I watched him get bear maced, which gave me kind of a boner, I'm gonna be honest with you.
It's not quite up there with the Richard Spencer punching, like meme worthy, but it's just as satisfying.
There's a great photo series of some guy Sieg Heiling, and then he's just getting rocked in the chin. It looks exactly like the cover of Vulgar Display of Power.
I have seen, you know, obviously I don't know how authentic it is, but someone took screenshots from whatever 4chan board this guy was on, supposedly, like, asking other Nazis for, like, help finding out who punched him and them telling him to go fuck himself for getting punched in the face and being a chump about it.
It's pretty fucked up that, again, this is another instance of, like, straight-up Nazi violence. One of these monsters killed a 32-year-old woman who I believe, I can't verify because I don't have any of the details in front of me. I believe she was an IWW member, which is, you know, basically Socialist Workers Union. Again, this is another instance where cops are obviously taking a side and protecting the fascists over leftist counter-protesters, which, I mean, I have opinions about what that means, but, you know, maybe nobody wants to hear those.
You just got to look at the pictures from Standing Rock versus pictures from Charlottesville. And that's all you really need to know about how authorities feel about these protests and the ones at Standing Rock.
I got to tell you, I'm extremely disappointed by a lot of liberals that I've seen commenting that agreeing that both sides are bad. I mean, if you've got two groups and one group is a Nazi, they're not both bad. One of them is bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's just absurd. I don't even know what to say to those people. I think they're just that kind of lukewarm, everybody's wrong except me, and you all need to listen to me because I have the blandest ideas possible and everything will be fine.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess in good times, 10 degrees left of center, and bad times, 10 degrees right. So I think that I've seen several GoFundMes up for counter-protesters that were jailed or otherwise injured by the Nazis. I would encourage you to, if you're sympathetic to this cause, which if you're listening to this show, you probably are, to consider giving a dollar or two to those guys. The J20 protesters are facing like 20 years in prison, and yet, none of these Nazis are going to have anything bad happen to them.
Well, there'll always be Nazis. That's pretty bad.
Yeah. I don't know. Let's see. It could go like American History X, you know. Norton. What was his name? Edward Norton? He was a Nazi. And then he got his asshole actually ripped apart, and then he stopped being a Nazi. So I don't want to say that maybe there's cause and effect, but there's a hope for some of these guys.
Well, we'll have to put that on the menu for them.
In the world of metal, what have you seen going on?
I know stuff's happened, but I'm more shocked that we haven't gotten some really bad hot takes over this past weekend's events from the usual suspects.
Well, I've seen Phil Labonte retweeting a whole bunch of dumb bullshit from, like, the Ben Shapiros of the world, who are, you know, desperate to try to distance themselves from this situation that they themselves have caused. They've whipped people up into this fury over the last decade or so, and they're like, I didn't do that. Sorry, Ben Shapiro voice is like, I didn't do that.
So he's the nerdier Urkel.
He's like 5'2", and I don't know if you ever caught his backstory, but like he was a virgin until he was married at the age of, like, I don't know, let's call it 30. So he's a 5'2" virgin, and it's fucking hilarious. But people take this guy super seriously. I think he has like the number 2 podcast on iTunes. So apparently we need to be like fucking loser wieners, like Milhouse sounding bitches, and we can get on the top 10.
You can't force it. It just has to happen naturally. So what has happened in the world of metal?
Man, I don't know. That's the thing. Like, I've been having such a terrible week that I didn't even get to look at anything. I don't think I've listened to a single note of music this week either. That's like a first time ever. So, I mean, like, okay, so off the top of my head, Dillinger Escape Plan announced their final show in Manhattan. And everybody immediately tried their best to get tickets. I saw a couple of our buddies did. I know Shane from Full Metal Hipster was able to get a ticket, and then everybody else basically got completely fucked. So those tickets are going on the secondary market for ridiculous sums of money.
It's not going to be their last show ever. Wait a year.
You really think so?
Yeah. No, I think so. No one stays retired forever unless, you know, a member dies, and even then that's never a guarantee that a band's going to stop. They'll need money in a couple years. I will not be surprised. They'll hop on some festivals in Europe. I mean, if the Misfits could get back together, Dillinger Escape Plan can get back together.
All right, folks, you heard it here. 365 says don't drop a grand on those DEP tickets.
Jeez, don't drop a grand on any band.
Okay, well, is there surely there's a band that you would drop a grand on, right?
Well, if someone was, like, you know, necromanced and brought back to life, sure.
Would you go see Dio? Is that your dude?
Not for $1,000.
Who is your necromance $1,000 artist?
I'm trying to think. I really don't know. Probably not in the world of metal. I mean, geez, maybe Elvis?
Yeah, I never figured you'd be an Elvis fan, to be honest with you.
Not necessarily, but it's more of the, you know, the guy.
I would love to see Elvis be necromanced and catch one final show, and he's just the same fat, shitty, drugged-up version from the later years.
See, but that would still be entertaining. That's the thing.
You're right. You're absolutely right. That would be something to watch. I don't know.
You know, just see him kind of gurgling through Jailhouse Rock. That's worth $1,000.
I would pay $1,000 to see a necromanced Beatles reunion so that I could throw trash at all of them.
Well, it's important to live your best life.
All right, man. I don't really have a whole lot more. I just wanted to be on this show because I'm desperate for validation. What do you say we kick into Death Eater, and then we listen to your interview, and then we play another song to close it out?
You haven't listened to anything in a week, so I think you need to really focus in on what you want to hear and then blast us at the end, right in the ears and facial area.
I'm going to blast you, blast every one of you. So thank you so much for doing this. Thanks so much for 36 Crazy Fists for gifting their time to us to do this. I'm out of here. I'll see you all next week.
Bye. Yeah.
Yeah, I went to Metallica last night with my buddy. So I head back to Anchorage tomorrow.
Oh, how was Metallica?
Unreal. Unreal show. Just fireworks, cannons, fire, you name it. It was pretty cool. It was fun to see.
Yeah, they're really the last band who could like still pull that off and not like come off as insincere.
Yeah, it was awesome. They played a lot of old stuff. They played some stuff off Garage Days. Like they played like Green Hell and The Weight. I was pretty stoked because they're my favorite band, and I've watched their set list kind of frequently to see what they're jamming, and I haven't seen Garage Days stuff on there very often. That's not like, I don't know, the whiskey in the jar type stuff. But
yeah,
anyway, it was cool. Really good show.
And no one peed on you like what happened at that other show a few days ago.
No, thank God. No, I saw that article. I'm glad that wasn't me.
Yeah, me too. All right, we'll get it kicked off here. You are listening to the Toilet of Hell radio show. I'm your excellent host, 365 Days of Horror. And joining me today is one of my favorite metal vocalists of all time, Brock from 36 Crazy Fist. How's it going, Brock?
I'm good, man. Thanks for the kind words. Appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a fan since Bitterness the Star, so this is a big deal for me.
Cool. Awesome.
So you just like a week and a half ago, you guys released a brand new song called Death Eater, and the new album is called Lanterns. What can you tell us a little bit about the new album?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just another chapter in the life of our band, really. You know, I mean, the album is definitely, you know, on the lyric side of it, you know, more of a time vault for me that I'm glad to look back on now and be in a different place than where I was when I was writing the album a couple years ago. But, you know, just life circumstance. Everybody goes through their ups and downs, and definitely I was going through that. So it's kind of a record of finding the correct ways to get yourself out of, you know, your depressive mental wars, and just, you know, another rock moody with some metal things here and there, but you know, it's just a moody rock record again, which is stuff that we kind of gravitate towards.
With the first single, it's called Death Eater. Is that kind of a direct response to all the things you were dealing with previously during the Time and Trauma era?
It's sort of a part two of those almost, mm-hmm. And not intentionally. But you know, it doesn't have anything to do with the passing of my mom, which is what the other album did. Time and Trauma was. This was more about, I went through just some major life changes, got divorced, and just got into a kind of a depressive state, had a failing business, and just wasn't very clear and present in my own life, and needed to kind of realize that I needed to speak out. I like to keep things to myself, and I don't think anybody really likes to voluntarily share their woes, and I'm certainly in that category. So I think once I did realize that I had a really great support group, and I have a really amazing family and friends, and they really helped me, and in turn I realized how much people need people, in a sense that you know, depression is a real issue, and we all have it, and it needs to be addressed. And you need to figure out the right tools to put one foot in front of the other and find your peace, your own closures on things of that nature. So I wasn't really sure when I started writing the album. Actually, I had the music for a while, and I didn't, things weren't just coming to me very easily, which sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But as a whole, I had a lot of these songs and I couldn't get anything going. I didn't really want to rehash the whole lyrical content of, oh, you know, my life is terrible and I'm going to sing about it again. You know, that did not attract me. So I didn't know what to do, really, even though I was dealing with all kinds of new ailments. So, you know, I think it took family, friends, my girlfriend that was like, yeah, go ahead, speak about those things. That's what you do. That's your outlet. And get off your chest. So I think once I kind of realized the correct way to write about these things, then it all kind of fell into place. But it was more of a struggle than I had in the past, which actually in turn became one of the most fun I'd ever had recording an album, because I was so rehearsed with the material. Hadn't demoed the material the last few albums, which is kind of strange, but the guys live in Portland, I live in Alaska, so I get the music sent to me through email, then I go to my, you know, and then I just kind of, some of the songs from like the entire last album, let's say, for example, I hadn't sang those songs full voice until the first day of actual recording of the album. So wow. It took a long time. Not everyone was familiar with my melodies, so that also was kind of a pain in the ass to try and get guys to be like, you see what I'm doing here? It's cool, right? And they're like, I don't really get it. So you're dealing with those things. And so on this album, I didn't want to do that. I wanted to really demo like we do it, like most bands do, and what like we had done in the past as well. So I flew down to Portland right before Thanksgiving, I believe, last year, and demoed the tracks, and then sat with them all the way till January. And man, I mean, I listened to them quite a bit and figured out what I liked, what I didn't like. And by the time it was time to really record the album, I had a 2-week block to record the album, and I was done with 7 songs in the first 3 days. So I think that was all a part of the homework and being prepared, and which in turn made it a lot more fun for everybody, really.
It sounds like it was a little bit of a cathartic back to basics for you and the rest of the band.
Yeah. Somebody asked me the other day, like, well, what's the difference in the songwriting, or has anything changed over the years? And I was like, no, not really. It's been the same. But actually, then I started thinking about it. It changed in the sense that it went back to the old way. And that's kind of a good feeling to get back to those ways. It was a formula that always worked. So I guess I kind of abandoned it for the last couple albums.
What does the name Lanterns mean in context to this album and to you?
Well, so there's this drive from Anchorage, where I live, to the little ski village called Girdwood. That's about, ironically, it's 36 miles from Anchorage. So I would drive that drive. It's one of the most beautiful drives in the world. It goes around on the coast. It's called the Turnagain Arm. And it's just a beautiful drive. And I was driving it on the weekends, every weekend, because my daughter's on the ski team and I ski too. So we would just be going down to the cabin, and I'd see this beautiful landscape, and I just was kind of thinking about just, you know, a man walking towards those mountains, trying to find, you know, his way out. But in the same time, where is he really walking to? It's pretty bleak. There's nothing over there but huge mountains. You're going to walk up those. I just had this vision. So when the title and the artistic vision that I had in my head for what the album layout would be, of course, I don't want anything to be left without some sort of strand of hope that you're going to get the right tools to get out of this situation that you're in, the way your life is, the way you've continued to have these things happen in your life. What are those steps that you've missed to get stuck? And it all just kind of came about. So the seeing the guy walking towards the mountains with a lantern in his hand or a flashlight or whatever it was initially, that lantern was a symbol of hope, I think, for me. And in turn, all these songs are about, it envelopes that entire mental war, that mental state, that depression. And I'm always trying to find some sort of positive. I mean, that's just, I'm really a pretty positive guy that's gone through some fairly dark years, not to say any darker than anyone else, but just for me personally, it's been a challenging time the last few years for me. And I've had to learn to accept that and combat that. And in turn, you really do learn some things about yourself, about how strong you are. And and how much ultimately we need to rely on our support groups, and that being another light source for me. So, you know, lanterns, I've got this whole career of writing these weird long titles and getting stuck with this and that, always having an and I really always was jealous of bands that could just come up with one powerful word. And so for me, it is powerful to me, and it's one word, and I'm very proud of that, that I finally got a title with just one word.
Well, it's great that you were able to recognize what type of place you were in, and to be able to move forward, and not only move forward personally, but also to create something out of it that you're really proud of. So, you know, I think that's something really special.
Yeah, thanks. I'm when I'm looking back on it, you know, you become so close to something that it's hard to separate from an outsider looking in. But looking back on it now and hearing the whole body of work as a whole, I think we wrote a really strong record that is really important to all of us. It's my drummer's second album with us now, but he's been in the band for about 6 years. But I'm super happy for him, because I know that he really wanted to kind of step out of Thomas, our old drummer's, shadow. Although, I mean, I think they're very similar, to be honest, but as far as their drumming styles. But this album, he really got to show his diversity, and I'm proud of that for him, because he's a very talented guy, and he's younger. He's younger than us, and I think he's got a wonderful career ahead of himself with us, hopefully for much longer, but even beyond that. He's just a very talented kid, and I'm really stoked for that he's in our band, and I listen to the music and the drums, and I'm really stoked on all the things he came up with drum wise.
One of the great things about 36 Crazy Fists is that you've pretty much been able to keep the same members for the most part throughout, you know, your entire career. You've had Steve Holt, you've had Mick Whitney's been around, left, and then came back. What do you think attributes to that ability to stick together this long?
Yeah, exactly. We've been lucky to be able to have the same guys. Thomas, he hated touring, and so after 18 years in the band, he was like, I'm out. And it's been such a great thing for him, because he's home, and it's where he wanted to be. He's not a very social person, so he was pretty miserable on the road. And so getting Kyle, who's another person we knew since he was like 14, we've known since he was a kid, you know, he was part of the family. So he was a nice fit, even though it was hard to get rid of or replace Thomas. I think that it attributes to us coming from Alaska, to be honest, because there hasn't been a lot of bands that have gotten to get outside of it and tour nationally and worldly or whatever. So I think we always took great pride in that, being pretty much the first band to do that. And I think in turn, it's not even about the band really so much anymore. We're such a family brotherhood. I mean, we all talk to each other every single day. We get annoyed with each other just like everybody would with their siblings. I just think it's beyond the band these days. It's like, you know, December will be 23 years old, and, you know, it's been half our lives, and we've seen the world because of it. So I think we all know how special it is, and how, you know, how lucky we are to still be doing it, because let's be honest, we haven't made a lot of money. You know, we've been one of these bands that's been around for a while, but just kind of grinded it out the whole time. We take pride in that for sure. But would we like to be, you know, where Killswitch Engage is, or Metallica for that matter? Absolutely. But those things haven't happened for us, but we still continue to grind, and we do it, I think, because we saw each other grow up and see these awesome things together, and we're really respectful of that. I think that none of us have taken this for granted, and I think we probably tried our best to stay the same dudes the whole time. I mean, obviously you change as you age, and maybe you get a little grumpier when there's the younger bands touring with you and you see their excitement and you're like, yeah, you know, calm down, dudes. But that's just getting old. And yeah, I think to answer your question, I think it's the Alaska thing. I mean, we're very proud of where we're from, and there hasn't been more than two or three bands that have really got to do this. So I think that's something that we're really proud of, and we don't want to give that up yet.
Yeah, not for nothing, but you managed to also survive being kind of lumped in with new metal bands and surviving Roadrunner Records. So you have a lot of notches on your belt.
We can take a punch, that's for sure.
Absolutely. You touched on touring a little bit, and you're about to head out on the road next week for a long snaking U.S. tour in support of Devil Driver. Do you have any sort of rituals or do anything to get ready for being out on the road for that long?
You know, it's weird because when you're off the road for a while, you really miss it. And when you're on the road for a while, you can't wait to get home. So it's this weird love hate. I'm excited to go out. I really am. We played two shows about a month ago up in Alaska, and it was so fun to be back with the boys and playing the new songs. We played like three or four new songs for, you know, in Alaska, we get a pretty nice pat on the back from our people there, you know, and so it's good to test out the new songs on them. I mean, to be honest, the reason Alaska's not a very flashy place, so they'll tell you if it sucks or not. And so I think it was pretty positive with the new songs. Yeah, I'm excited. There's no real ritual other than I think we have to stay on top of certain things, whereas we're kind of known, at least in our small circle of the people that work for us through management and booking agents, that we're these, you know, crazy road dogs, and we want to be out the whole time, and I'll sing 27 nights in a row. And that was the things that we used to really pound our chest about, but I really don't like to do that stuff anymore. I was just looking at all the dates. I think it goes from next week, next Friday or whatever, to October 24th it ends. And then we go to Europe and the UK and Australia, and that ends. That leads us all the way to Christmas.
Wow.
The thing is, I guess what I'm getting at is these days it's a little bit harder to do that. I mean, I have an 8-year-old daughter. My bass player has three kids. So the other thing is, luckily, we all have someone back home that is willing to. My ex-wife and I are still best friends, and she's very cool to me, and she knows this is my life, and this is how I make my money when I'm on the road. So if the kid needs extra clothes on her back and they're coming from dad, he's got to be out working. So it's all a part of it. But I think the one thing I do like to stay on top of on this album for sure is to make sure that everybody gets a chance to go home every once in a while and recharge the batteries, because you need it, number one, and we owe it to our kids, number two, and, you know, to keep morale up, you got to take breaks here and there. So not to say we're not going to be out for a year and a half on the album, because we are, but I just want to make sure that the band does get some moments to go home, recharge, and I think everyone needs that in this business. It's like anything. I mean, there's people that work on the North Slope up in Alaska. They go two on, two off, three on, three off, whatever it is. But once you do something every day for 3 weeks straight, you're going to need a couple days to get your mind back with you. So those are the things I want to be conscious of this go around, because at the end of the last one, everybody was pretty shot.
Yeah, I think the kids will understand that daddy needs to go melt some faces every once in a while.
She does. she loves the rock and roll, and 36 is now her second favorite band, which we got knocked out from the Pretty Reckless. My daughter likes any band that has girl rock singers, which is cool.
Oh, that's good. So, there's no shortage of that.
No, yeah, you know, and when she was real young, she wouldn't let me put on anything in the truck that wasn't screaming. If there was vocals that weren't screaming, she didn't like it, which I always thought was so awesome. But now I see that's kind of changed, and she wants to hear girl voices. So whatever it is, but
You eventually lead her into like the symphonic metal and power metal.
There you go. Yeah, like some what's that girl's, the redhead girl, Epica.
Epica. Yep.
Yeah, I'll turn her on to that stuff.
Yeah. See, I was, when I saw the dates announced for the Devil Driver tour, and then we scheduled this interview, I was ready to give you a little bit of shit because you weren't coming to my town and hadn't played here in like over 10 years. But I saw that you're also doing a couple of small headline shows with The Last 10 Seconds of Life, and you're actually coming to where I am in Providence. So I'm really excited about that.
Oh, nice. Yeah, we hadn't been to Providence in a long time.
I think the last time you're supposed to be here, I think, was like with Straight Line Stitch and ended up canceling that. And that was like 10 years ago.
Yeah, we broke down in Florida, if I remember correctly. And then that was like the third breakdown of that tour. And we were like, nope, we're going to go home now.
So do you do anything to like stay sane on the road, like watch a lot of Netflix or read a lot of books?
Boy, I like to say that I read less frequent than I used to. Netflix, I'm not a big, I'm a weird dude when it comes to that stuff. Like everyone will say, hey, have you seen the new this or that? And I'm like, nope, never seen it. They're like, what? And that stems from Breaking Bad to Lost to Game of Thrones, Dexter, any of those big series that everybody was really into, I've never even seen them. So here's the thing. When I watch TV, it's sports. I love hockey. Hockey's my favorite thing. And I like football. I like sports. And movies, I don't know. When I'm trying to watch like movies or these series every once in a while, my mind is so elsewhere. It's like, oh, did I get that merch order in? Or I don't know. I can't turn off my brain sometimes. But with sports, I can. And I don't know what that's all about, but I don't know. I should probably try and read a little more actually on this tour, though, because I've not been reading as much as I used to, and I like books.
You mentioned hockey, and I am sitting here in my New York Rangers T-shirt, and you're actually a Flyers fan. How did that happen?
We've got a bad connection here. We still on? I didn't hear you correct.
New York Rangers fan. Okay. I know. I'm saying it with pride because we won a Stanley Cup more recently than you have.
Yes, you did. 1994.
Yep.
How did I become a Flyers fan? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Growing up where we did, we don't have a pro team. So everybody's got a different pro team. But most of the kids that I grew up with, we all loved the Oilers originally. We loved Gretzky, still love Gretzky. But at some point around 9 or 10 years old, we were watching hockey, and my dad was telling me that the Flyers back in the 70s were these really tough guys. They're called the Broad Street Bullies, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, really? So I started following more of their games. I loved Halloween. They were orange and black. And I just think that my dad telling me that they were really the tough guys, I liked that. And that's how they became my team.
You know, you have you're hooked up with Puck Hockey and had your own like line of T-shirts that were kind of 36 Crazy Fists / hockey related paraphernalia. And right. I couldn't bring myself to buy something because it was Flyers colors.
I know, you know, a lot. So my best friends, my three best friends, one is a Devils fan, one is a Rangers fan, one is a Penguins fan. So we battle our whole lives together. And every one of them said the same exact thing. Like, dude, I'm not buying that. That's Flyers colors. I'm like, no, dude, that's just the NHL colors. But, yeah, and it's funny. We just came out with our new merch that's about to be sold on our tour, and I was showing my Devils buddy, Devils fan buddy the other day, and he's like, dude, it's orange and black again. I'm like, no, that's gold, and it really is. It's gold and black, but it does look kind of orangish on the screen, but yeah, hockey's great, man, and I love the Eastern Conference for sure. I really don't follow the West all that much, to be honest, until the playoffs. I'm an Eastern Conference guy.
Yeah, what you have to do is, like, for the next album, name it something like Hextall or Brendamore, and so that way, when you make the shirt, you could put 36 on the back and, you know, make people wear Hextall or Brendamore or Leclerc or something like that.
That'd be the ultimate revenge, wouldn't it?
They have to wear, and they have to suffer wearing an old Flyer.
Oh, that's funny. That's hilarious.
So with this new album, in the past, 36 Crazy Fists has had a bunch of guest vocalists on the album. Is that going to be more of the same on this one?
No, there's actually none.
Wow.
Somebody else brought that the other day. I don't really think about it, but I guess we had one on every album. And not that I didn't know that. Of course, I knew that. But this one, I did have a couple guys in mind that I actually spoke to. Jesse from Killswitch and Ryan from Demon Hunter. We were all going to do something together. And then just as a time went on, literally we were writing this album for 2 years, and I think I asked those guys early in the writing process just to see how they were feeling about it, and we all discussed it and want to do it. But when it came time to do it, it was just kind of like, let's just get it done. I hadn't spoke to those guys about it for a while, and so there's that. So yeah, it's just me this time, me and Holt.
There's always the potential for a little vocalist side project with you and a couple of other well-known metal guys that you have.
Yeah, one of these days, I know Jesse and I have discussed it for many years, of doing some sort of blues, moody rock project, maybe even just acoustic thing, but both of us suck at playing guitar, so we're going to have to get a little better at that before we hit the coffee shops.
Well, I mean, if you play that show in Providence, I know he doesn't live that far away. Maybe you could always get it together, at least for one night.
Yeah, well, one of these days. I'm a massive fan of Jess. It would be fun to do something with him. And, you know, we're still young men, so hopefully one day we can get it pulled off.
Yeah, absolutely. Any plans for more covers? I know in the past you've done, like, Sad Lisa, Mother Mary, Workhorse, and I always really enjoy those songs as well. Or any more on the docket?
We did, let's see, we did We Die Young for this album, which is Alice in Chains cover.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, and that you can find, it's on YouTube now, because it came out on last week. It was on Metal Hammer's, they had like a CD that comes with the magazine, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, the sampler.
Remembering the 90s, so it's a whole bunch of bands doing 90s covers, which I didn't even know we were gonna, we did it, and then nobody even told me we were gonna be on that thing, so I found out through YouTube, and which is great. I mean, I'd love to be, you know, included, but no one told me that we were going to, so I all of a sudden it just appeared out, and I was like, oh cool, because I wasn't sure what we were gonna do with it, and we did that. And then the boys, they all recorded 3 Misfits songs for the album too, but Holt sang on all those. I didn't do those. So, and I want them to come out because they're awesome and Steve sounds great on them, but I'm not sure how that will transpire. But there was one cover that we were all really stoked to do that we haven't done yet, but I think we're going to make it really cool once we do. And we're going to do Maggie May, a Rod Stewart song. So we'll see if that ever transpires as well.
Oh, that sounds pretty good. Do you all have to like agree on which song you want to do, or is it just like, that's it, we're doing Maggie May, you guys better learn it?
No, we don't really operate like that. We're diplomatic. Everybody has a say, and nobody's bossing anybody around really.
So this is you're gonna be touring for your 7th album. When it comes to playing live, how do you go about picking songs from your set list?
Well, the nice thing is I used to write the set list every night for all those years. And when Kyle joined the band, I kind of made him start doing it because he's got really nice handwriting. and we were still not like printing off things. So I don't do it anymore. I get on stage and I look at the set list. I mean, once you're touring for a couple weeks straight, you kind of know what's happening, and we slide things in and out that aren't working. But for the most part, we'll just kind of get stuck on the same set list, which kind of sucks, but try to be better about that this go around. I mean, there's bands like that I noticed, like Pearl Jam never plays the same set list night after night. It's totally different. I don't know if we have as many songs as Pearl Jam. I probably not, but we have quite a few songs these days. So we could also do those kind of things, which I think is cool for the fans. But really I don't pay attention to it as much anymore, cause I know Kyle's doing it, and I'll sing anything. I'll get up and do pretty much anything. So if there's something that's unrehearsed, that would be strange, cause I don't think any of us would do it. So I pretty much know usually what's going to happen, but I don't put the orders in anymore. I kind of like that. It used to be like this stressful thing, like, oh, you guys are on stage 10 minutes. Okay, cool. And then I'll be like, and then somebody's like, where's the set list? And I'm like, oh, okay. I got to write those out real quick. You know? So I'm glad I don't have that job anymore. Not that I have so many jobs that I couldn't remember that thing, but it was just one of those things that sometimes would catch me off guard that I would forget about.
Yeah, well, I mean, if someone else is doing it, you could always look down and see Left Hand Charity or something off a Boss Buckle, and then you're screwed.
That would be impressive, because if that showed up, we'd have to do some serious – I'd have to go to YouTube immediately and start listening to that thing again to remember what happened.
Is it difficult to, you know, perform live, like some of your really personal songs, like 11-24-11 or Song for the Fisherman?
No, because I think the way I always looked at those things was that I was getting closure on them by performing them and finding peace in the whole situation by being able to get it out of me. And I don't think I've ever looked at any song where I was like, okay, I wrote that and I never want to play that again. I wrote it for a reason, to have some sort of therapy or remedy for my own healing. And we never played Song for a Fisherman live. So that's kind of one of those songs that would be weird to do live, I think. But 11-24-11, I mean, that thing was a banger. We haven't mm-hmm. played it lately, but we played it quite a bit on the last album cycle, and it was fun to play live. And that was a heartbreaking song to write. I mean,
sure.
There's some, you know, I wrote that song the night my mom passed away, which was mm-hmm. Thanksgiving night, after we had family dinner, and it was a heavy, heavy night for sure. And I do like that I wrote that song that night, just because it kind of adds the volume of the content. You know, the vibe was very weighty, if you will. But no, to answer your question, no, I don't ever look at it like that. I think it's more of a therapy, a self-help or something like that, to just get it out and just scream it out. It feels good.
Yeah. So when I was 14, I lost my mother, and I think there's a camaraderie between people that have lost a parent in their life, you know, and I think, at least for me, it's really great to hear other people talk about it, and to like hear it in songs, and to, you know, read it on a piece of paper. So, how does it feel to, I guess, put your own words like into a song? And
I don't think I ever had such important lyrical content as I had on the Time and Trauma album for me personally. Like, I'd never had written with so much vitriol and sorrow, and I had used music for this outlet my whole career, as things that were needed to get off my chest, and et cetera, or something about a wonderful relationship. But all this stuff was very life-affirming material for me. And until I had to go through that with my mom, it made everything prior to it seem so lightweight. And it was. To be honest, it was, compared to, you know, sitting with my mom for a year straight and watching her eventually pass away. That was a hard ordeal, but there was also a positive to it. And I look back on all that stuff, and I'm really grateful that I got that time to spend with my mom. And we spoke about so many things, about life and memories and all this awesome stuff that I look back on now. And I'm so grateful I had the music to write about it. And also, sitting here today with a brand new album, I'm really glad not to be in that space anymore. Of course, we're in a different space, and it's equally challenging, but it's not the same. You know, my situations on this album aren't about death. They're about life. And the good thing about that is there's always time, while your heart's still beating, there's always time to fix your life. When you're dead, there's not. So it's two different things, but I think getting to write about my mom's passing was a very helpful thing for me. I found a lot of peace and a lot of closure from writing that album.
Definitely. I know we've been talking about sort of heavier subjects, so I'm going to kind of turn the corner and lighten things up. But now that we're heading towards the end,
cool.
You had a recipe in Mosh Potatoes, the metal cookbook, for reindeer sausage and pasta. Is that kind of your go-to meal?
Well, I love spaghetti, man. I just love spaghetti. I love lasagna. I'm an Italian fan. I'm not a very good cook at all. And when I got asked to put the recipe in there, I was like, well, I do make a pretty decent spaghetti. I mean, anybody can make spaghetti, but mine's pretty good. The reindeer sausage is very Alaskan. So I don't always use reindeer sausage. I mean, it's not always available, I guess. But I thought it sounded cool for the cookbook. But I do cook a lot of pasta. And my weight these days definitely shows that.
So I've never had reindeer. What's it like?
Well, it's a lot less gamey than moose. I don't know if you've had moose before, but that's a very big Alaskan staple. I mean, moose burgers, moose sausage, it's delicious. But reindeer is much more, it's delicious. I love it. But it's not, I don't think you would be able to tell that it's like totally different than like cattle. You know what I mean?
So it's like, I can't believe it's not reindeer.
Exactly. Yeah. Reindeer, you know, I think it's almost more of a gimmick up there because there's like so many restaurants that advertise reindeer sausage. And it's like, well, it's not that, it's not like it's ostrich or anything like that. It's like, there's a lot of reindeer around there.
What's one or two things you'd like people to know about Alaska from the lower 48 states?
Let's see. I think the people in Alaska, in my experience growing up there, are still, to this day, very blue-collar, very not flashy at all. You know, fashion's not a big deal up there. So that being said, it's got that blue-collar ethic where if your truck goes into the ditch in the winter, three people pull over and help you get out. And I still see that today. And that's something I'm very, that's why I live there. I don't like big cities. Even though Anchorage is a fairly big city, it's still a pretty small city, in this big scheme of things. So I think I'd like people to know that the people up there are very welcoming and really, I think mindful of each other and do care about one another. There's a sense of community there. The local music scene is awesome. It always has been. It's supported heavily by the locals. And there's a lot of good people up there. So I think that would be, you know, they always say, I don't know if you ever have heard this term, but I always hear this term that, like, Canadians are super nice people. I don't know if that has gotten to Providence, where you're kind of more Eastern Canada. But at least Western Canada, there's this thing about Canada being very friendly. And I think I also think the same thing about Alaska, which makes sense because we're connected to Canada. There's a lot of Canadians up there. There are a lot of my friends are Canadian. So anyway, I'm not sure where I'm getting on this, but I just think that the people, for the most part, are very welcoming. And when their tourism is a big deal up there, and it's a big revenue source for the state, and I think people would be pleasantly surprised coming from the East Coast, especially where it is very fast paced. You come to Alaska, it's much more slowed down. You get outside, you can be from one side of Anchorage to the other in 20 minutes. Traffic is minimal. And next thing you know, you're out in the woods or you're out by the water, and you can find a real sense of calm, I think, up there. And that's why I love it so much. That's why I hope to die there one day.
If the Northeast is certainly full of pushy assholes, so maybe I'll have to pay a visit to Alaska at some point. So just final question, would you ever consider, I know, I feel like you did this at one point, but playing a full album start to finish, what album would that be?
Well, we did it for Bitterness on the 10-year. We never did anything for Snowcat, but we played so much Snowcat material that out of any record, that album has the most songs that it's got to keep in the set list. But we didn't do a 10-year, and a lot of our longtime fans, it's their favorite album. So I think we should probably do Snowcapped in its entirety. I guess that would be the second one in line to do one with.
Yeah, and then you'd have to play Song for the Fisherman if you do that.
Yeah, I guess we would have to. I have to relearn that poem.
What does Bitterness the Star mean? I've always wanted to ask.
Well, it's a poison. So in the Bible, the star was named Bitterness, which also is wormwood. It's part of Revelations. I was getting my heavy metal Revelations days. And yeah, it just means a poison.
Gotcha. Is there anything else that you want to touch on before we finish up?
Not really. Just grateful to everyone that listens to our band and comes to the shows and supports us. And we're looking forward to seeing the world again on the new album.
Excellent. Thank you very much for doing this. Really do appreciate it.
Yeah, man, that was fun. We'll be right back.
You're listening to 66.6 FM. Radio TOVH. The Flush.